Now let's take our Bibles, please, and turn to the book of Genesis. And we are in chapter number 30. Let me set our context again. Of course, our basic context is from Hebrews 11, where we're now studying men of faith, women of faith, and those who are examples of faith. And so now we're talking about the sixth example in Hebrews 11, and that is Jacob. In the 28th chapter, we found two truths that were revealed to Jacob, and that is Christ is the ladder, picture of a ladder that reaches from heaven and down to earth. And the second thing we saw in that chapter is what he called the dreadful place. And by the dreadful place, he means the awesome place, the only place of worship. So Jacob, along with all who are given eyes to see and ears to hear, Christ is the only way to God, and Christ is the only mediator between God and man. And Jesus said as much in our reading a little earlier, in that most familiar statement, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life, no man comes unto the Father but by me. That's what the 28th chapter concerns. Now in the 29th chapter, we saw the key statement at the end of that chapter where Christ is the Lion of the tribe of Judah. It is Judah, the tribe of Judah, the Lion of Judah, through whom David will come, and then, of course, through Christ, through whom Christ will come. Christ alone is that Lion of the tribe of Judah, and he's referred to in the Revelation in chapter 5, where he, by his own obedience and blood, was enabled to open the book of redemption. John lamented in chapter 5 and then exalted with these words, Thou, talking to and of Christ, Thou art worthy to take the book and to open the seals thereof, that is, the book of redemption and the revelation of redemption, and the seals thereof, the laying out of the unfolding of history. For thou wast slain, and thou hast redeemed us to God. It isn't that he just won a redemption. He actually redeemed us to God. He didn't make a ground of redemption. He redeemed us to God. And he said, To God by thy blood, out of every kindred and tongue and people and nation. And so what he's talking about not all men without exception of any, but he's talking about all kinds of men, both Jews and Gentiles. So in the 28th chapter, you have the ladder and you have the dreadful place. In 29, you have the Lion of the tribe of Judah. So what is chapter 30? Well, in chapter 30, we see that Christ is sovereign. So we find the sovereignty of Christ in this 30th chapter. The Lord repeated this truth, of course, while he was up on the earth. He demonstrated it in his healings. You see it very early in Matthew, the 4th chapter, after he had gone into the wilderness for his temptations. After that, you have the recording of all the many miracles that he performed, and the chapter closes, or at least close to it, with words like this. Jesus went about healing all manner of sickness and all manner of disease among the people, and there followed him great multitudes of people from Galilee and from Decapolis and from Jerusalem and Judea and beyond Jordan, which would be to the east. And so all of these miracles that he performed were not an end in themselves, but they are an authentication of his person and his work. We read in our passage a few minutes ago where he said, Believe me for the work's sake. In other words, because of these works, believe that I am who I say I am. So he demonstrated his sovereignty by his healings. But he also declared his sovereignty in salvation. In John 10 and verse 16, in reference to the Gentiles, he said to them, I must bring He didn't say I might or I might not. He didn't say I'm going to give them a chance if they'll only accept me. He said them I must bring and they shall hear my voice. Those definite statements, I must bring them and they shall hear my voice. And the same truth is illustrated in Luke 15 where he tells the parable of the sheep that is lost. And he goes out into the wilderness and he lays that sheep upon his shoulders and brings him home. Well, that's a picture of him coming to earth and him laying his sheep upon his shoulders and bringing them all the way home. He didn't put a noose around our neck and drag us along. No, sir. He put us upon his shoulders and he brings us along. You may not think so, but you're here hearing this gospel and rejoicing in this gospel because he put you on his shoulders and he brought you all the way. He declared his sovereignty in salvation. So that's just a little about that. But then he defended his sovereignty at his ascension, saying in Matthew 28 and verse 18, just before he ascended, all power, and that word is authority, all authority is given unto me in heaven and in earth. So in other words, he's saying, I do what I will. I do when I will. I do with whom I will. I do my will all the time. So now to you and to me, we see great pain and agony and hurt in this world. And yet we know that he is sovereign. Now most of God's elect, maybe all of them, I don't know for sure, but most that I know of, come to the gospel by the way of God's sovereignty. Now God's sovereignty is not the gospel, but it is the opening of the door to the gospel. His sovereignty in the salvation of sinners and his definite and limited redemption, that is one that was won by Christ, is what follows when you see his sovereignty. So once you believe that he is sovereign, then you must come to see that he is sovereign in the most important thing of all, and that is the salvation of sinners. And that must be the most important thing, for that's the reason that Christ left heaven and came to earth. And then we must take a step beyond that, and that is God bringing his called ones, the ones that he put upon his shoulder, to see that he justified and he redeemed and he remitted sins, forgave sins, exclusively at and by and through and in connection with that cross, with the event of the cross. And it is this that stands supreme. Because some may say, well, why does it make any difference? Well, it makes a difference because of what took place at the cross. That's the difference. That's why we must see that he didn't justify in eternity before there was sin. He didn't justify at faith when we believe. No, sir. What makes the difference is what did he actually accomplish at the cross? He actually forgave sin, actually reconciled to God, actually justified his people to himself. The amazing thing is that you don't become tired of me saying that, because we know that Jesus in Matthew 7 said, few there be that find it. Narrow is the way, and few there be that find it. Now with that said, with that truth of sovereignty, his sovereign rule and the providence of God are evident in this chapter. We know that Jacob is a man of self-interest. And yet we know that his self-interest and his sin cannot and will not stop nor detour God's perfect will. So what we're going to see is that God's will is having sway in the life of Jacob. And in this chapter, we begin to see just a glimpse that Jacob is beginning to see and discover who God is. So I want you to read with me the first two verses, please. I'm in Genesis 30. And Rachel saw that she bare Jacob no children. Rachel envied her sister and said unto Jacob, give me children or else I die. Jacob's anger was kindled against Rachel. And he said, it's a question, am I in God's stead? Who hath withheld from thee the fruit of the womb? Now in that day, the woman was disgraced. It was more than just a desire. In our day, it's a desire, I suppose. And I don't mean to speak for women. I, not being one, I don't really understand all the drive to have children. But I can see that it is, in many cases, a very motivating factor. But in this world, the world they were in, it was an absolute disgrace not to have a son or to have more than one son. And the more sons you had, the more blessed they thought themselves to be. Well, in chapter 29, Leah was a sad person. Now in chapter 30, Rachel is a sad person. So you have these two women who have great sadness in chapter 29 and in chapter 30. And so she asked this question, and what we're able to do here, not that we really want to, but we see a family argument. We see a marital argument that is going on here because Rachel is blaming Jacob, and Jacob has something pretty important that he's going to say here. And so that's kind of what is happening here. We're going to come back and talk about the statement that he makes, or in terms of a question, am I in God's stead, a little bit more. But no matter what Leah does, Rachel is always going to be the one that Jacob will love the most. Now we know that there are some children that are born. There's Reuben, who is the first, but he's going to lose his place in the family. And then we know that Simeon and Levi come next, but they're involved in violence. And then the fourth comes Judah, and he's named at the end of our last chapter. And it is through Judah, as I've said, Christ will come. Now, from verse 3 down through verse 21, Rachel is going to do what her mother-in-law did, what Rebekah did. And she is going to give her handmaiden to Jacob, and children are going to be born by him, and she thinks that that's going to solve her problem. Of course, it will not. But I'm not going to go through all of that. You can read that on your own. I suggest you do it at a different time rather than right now. And I want you to stay with me. So if you would please, would you place your eyes on verse number 22, verse number 22. And God remembered Rachel, and God hearkened to her, and he opened her womb. Now when it says God remembered Rachel, it doesn't mean that he had forgotten her. It means that God's will is now about to come to pass for her, just as he had planned for it to. And God hearkened to her, and he opened her womb. He answered her prayer. And she conceived, and she bare a son, and she said, God hath taken away my reproach. So there's her sadness from the first verse. And she called his name, and what is that name? Joseph. And Joseph is going to become the principal figure beginning in chapter 37 all the way to the end of the chapter. There's actually more told to us about Joseph than about anyone else. And Joseph is the man who actually is probably the most clear picture and the most developed picture of Christ in all of the Old Testament. And she called his name Joseph, and the Lord shall add to me another son. And so she believed that she would have not only one, but she would have a pair of sons. And in verse 25, it came to pass when Rachel had borne Joseph that Jacob said unto Laban, send me away that I might go into my own place and to my own country. And so next time, the Lord willing, we'll come back and we'll talk about what takes place from verse 25 and forward. But I want to go back, and I want to talk with you a little bit about what Jacob said in verse number 2. So if you'll return back there, please. Jacob and Rachel are angry with each other. And anger is always a very destructive thing. Yet in the heart of Jacob, he's beginning to see something. And I believe that he's beginning to see that I am not God. He had orchestrated things with his dad and with his brother that put him in the position of being God. I'm in the stead of God. He orchestrated those things along with his mother. Now then, he's come through with all of these different experiences. Think of all that he's gone through. Those work for the 7 years and then the 14 years, so you have the double satisfying of the law and the cold nights and the cold wind, and finally he's beginning to see, I am not God. I'm not God of my life. I'm not God of your life. I'm not God of children. I'm not God of anything. Having these children was so important because every one of them was looking for a son that would be the chosen seed. They didn't know who that would be. And they're looking for the chosen seed. He asked this question, am I in God's stead? Now, I think every day when we get up and we go about whatever we're going to do, we ought to ponder over a thought like this, am I in God's stead? And the answer is no, you are not in God's stead. God is God, and you are just a man or a woman or a boy or a girl upon this earth. And you're just going about your life, but you are not in God's stead. So I want you to think about this just a little bit with me. I have just a little bit to say, not a lot, but Jacob, in effect, is saying, do you take me to be God? Well, you know that she didn't. Do you think I have the power over fertility and the power to require of God a son for you? You know I don't. Do you think I'm withholding a son from you for some reason? You know that is not true, he's saying to her. Jacob knew that children were the gift of God. He understood that truth, and it would in time be put in writing by the psalmist who said, lo, children are a heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. What Jacob is learning is this one simple truth that you and I need to know, yea, we must know, and that God is sovereign. God is sovereign. He's sovereign over all things. The psalmist said in 135 in verse 6, whatsoever the Lord pleased, that did he in heaven and in earth and in the seas and in all deep places. Think of it. Down at the bottom of the oceans, God's will is being exercised for every rock that is there, for every growth of the smallest kind. He is the Lord, and he is doing what he pleases to do, and he's doing that way all the time. Then listen to what Isaiah said. He said, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, I will do all my pleasure. Someone might say to me, David, you need to be more practical in your preaching. Well, somehow or another, in my mind, I think I am practical. I think that I'm being practical when I tell you that God is sovereign and you're just a man or a woman upon this earth. Poor old Jonah was just a man upon this earth, and God was God and created a storm and created a fish and had him swallowed and took him to the place where he wanted him to be and had him spit out upon the shore. And what did Jonah say when it was all said and done? Salvation is of the Lord. That's what he learned. How did he learn it? He learned it because he learned that God is sovereign. But if you don't believe that God is sovereign, you'll never know that he is sovereign in the salvation of sinners. Listen to what Daniel said. Daniel said, and all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. Can you think of yourself as that, as nothing? Just nothing. Think of, we're all passing away. All of us are getting older. Most of us are far closer to the end than we were at the beginning. It's hard for me to believe that I've been preaching for over 5 decades, one message or another, but over 5 decades now. Started when I was just a boy, trying to preach, but over 5 decades. Well, I don't have that many years left. It's close now. It's close to the end. I am reputed as nothing, and one of these days it'll just be gone, and I'll be a faded memory, and even few will even remember. He said, declaring the end from the beginning, the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He doeth according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none, not one, can stay his hand or say unto him, what doest thou? He is Lord. He is sovereign. And the sooner you are satisfied that he is sovereign in your life, the sooner you're going to be happy in this world. Now listen to what Paul said in Romans. He said, what wilt thou say unto me? This is what Paul is quoting God to say. Why doth he yet find fault? Or who hath resisted his will? Nay, but O man, who art thou that repliest against God? Shall the thing formed say to him that formed it, why hast thou made me thus? Hath not the potter power over the clay of the same lump to make one vessel unto honor and the other unto dishonor? Now do you understand what he's saying? God is the potter. He's the potter. You and I come from the same lump of clay as all men upon this earth. We're not better than anybody else. Because we believe in sovereign grace, because we believe in God's election, we certainly do not believe that we are better than somebody else. Because we're just clay, but he makes one unto honor. That's a picture of salvation. That's what he's talking about in Romans 9. And then the vessel of dishonor, that doesn't mean they're not rich or have much in this world, but they're a vessel of dishonor in that no salvation is given unto them. He is the Lord over both the vessels of honor and the vessels of dishonor. Listen to what Jesus said in Matthew 19 and verse 26. Jesus beheld them and he said unto them, this is following, talking about the rich man and what he needed to give away. And he said, with men, this is impossible, but with God, all things are possible. In other words, had I chosen to turn this rich young ruler, I could have done it. That's what he means. Had I wanted to turn him to me, I could have and I would have. But the rich young ruler went away sorrowful and the Lord left him in his sins. I don't know if he called him at another time. I only know that he didn't at that time. But he said, with God, all things are possible. Paul put it this way, the same thing in Romans or in Ephesians 3 and 20. Now unto him that is able to do exceeding abundantly above all that we ask or think. Now, have you ever pondered that statement? All that you can think, all that you can ask, all of it, above it, abundantly above it, exceedingly abundantly above it. He's able to do all that according to the power that worketh in us. It takes a tremendous power to cause you to love the gospel. It takes a tremendous power to pull you away from the allurement of the trinkets of this world and its philosophies and its religion. It is that great power that is working in us to cause us to know him and to love him. Let me give you one more passage and I'm going to stop. In Acts chapter 13 and verse 47, it says this, for so hath the Lord commanded unto us, saying, I have set thee, he's talking about what he said to Christ, I have set thee to be a light to the Gentiles, that thou shouldest be for salvation to the ends of the earth. And when the Gentiles heard this, they were glad. And they glorified the word of the Lord, that is the gospel. And then listen to his summation. As many as were ordained to eternal life believed. Jim, he did not say as many as believed were ordained to eternal life. He said, Steve, as many as were ordained to eternal life believed. Which came first? Believing or his sovereignty? His sovereignty came first. Absolutely, in the most absolute sense, we believe because he is sovereign. Brethren, may God teach us. May God enable us to rest in his sovereignty. I rejoice with my brother Jacob that he's beginning to see God's sovereignty.